Here we go.
So, two handouts today. So pick up one of each. Stefan? Okay. So there are, maybe first of all an apology which I keep, which I think I've repeated more than once. So again, this is sort of, classes are not supposed to be on work in progress, but I just couldn't resist it because, it is the strongest not invariant, the strongest computable not invariant. Why would I talk about anything else? But this said, it means that things change as we go. So what happened over the weekend is that I realized that I can simplify something about G1, something that we didn't do yet, and also a little bit about G0, by quite a margin. And then I felt that I really have to talk about it, but I'm not really prepared because it's totally fresh. So hopefully it will work out well, but there are risks associated with this. Anyway, we start with something else. So I wanted to start with finishing off G0. And again, it's not really finishing off because there is way too much to say beyond, but it's finishing off for now, okay? So first of all, a quick review. So we had this main G0 theorem, which said that, using the reordering relations written here, you can, using the R matrix, the so-called R matrix, though it has nothing to do with a matrix, the R element, using the solution of Young-Baxter, which appears here, and the three reordering lemmas, you can compute the invariant of any knot whatsoever in polynomial time. And this is by writing it as an ordered exponential in the elf order, the choice of elf is partially because of the six possible orderings, this is one of the two easiest, and then of those two, it's the one that sounds like an elf. So it's not really significant, okay? I could have written it in any other order, and the result would be maybe a tiny, some constants would change, but it's not really dramatic. Anyway, in elf ordering, the invariant is written as omega e to the l plus q, where basically all the hard information is in q, and q is a quadratic in e and f with coefficients which are, and that's the ugly bit, the coefficients are rational functions in the hi's and their exponentials, okay? But then when you actually play with it a little bit, you find that the denominators are kind of always the same, and you find that h appears rather trivially in the answer. So you hope to be able to write it only in terms of the ti's, which are the exponentials of the hi's, and it turns out that you can, and I have nothing wise to say about it. So this is Roland sort of sees it as a part of a bigger pattern, which is somehow related to quantum groups. But to me, this is just an ad hoc change of variable. So basically, you look at the formula written here, e to the h minus 1 over h, or e to the sine times h minus 1 over h, and you say, if I swallow this factor into the E, everything becomes simpler. And again, I have no moral justification. It just works. Okay? So you set E bar to be E to the H minus 1 over H. And then the claim is that if you write everything, I marked in yellow the things that change. So if you write it in E bar elf order, which probably should be, you know, probably should you should rename E bar to E to keep it elf order. But I want to keep the distinction. So if you write it in E bar order, the answer is always omega inverse times e to the L plus omega inverse q, and now omega and the coefficients of q are not rational functions but polynomials, and these are polynomials in half as many variables, so in the variables ti, which are e to the hi. Okay? And most of the proof is easy, and the rest of it is too hard. So let me explain. So mostly you just rewrite the lemma in terms of E bar instead of E, and then you simply see that, well, okay, so this is a polynomial, right? Basically, you see that everything goes through with some minor modifications that come because of the change of variables. However, okay, so this totally explains why the H variables disappears and or disappear and only the T variables remain. Namely, if you look at this, no H's survive. After the change of variables, there's just no AH's. Everything is written in terms of T. So only T's appear. Okay? But it doesn't explain why the coefficients of Q, as written now, will always be polynomials. Or in other words, why the coefficients of Q, as it was written before, have a common denominator omega. Right here I just pulled out the common denominator. Okay? And I actually don't have a good explanation for that. So I have several kind of roundabout explanation, but the obvious explanation, the easy explanation should be that basically this property that Q, as written in this language, remains with polynomial coefficients is carried by induction. So basically, if it's true before doing a swap, it's true after doing a swap. Right? That would be the good proof. That basically, it stays that way. Okay? If it starts that way, it stays that way. But if you look at the formulas, then at some point you take Q, so here is Q before applying an FE swap, and here it is after, and it gets multiplied by nu, where nu has a denominator. So therefore, whatever occurs here must be divisible by that. And I don't know how to give, in order for the theorem to be true, okay? And I don't know how to give, and sorry, is this, no, I said it wrong. Sorry, that's not the issue. Rather than saying what I can't do correctly, let me just say that I can't do it, okay? So the proofs that I have are by saying, are either by much more complicated induction, so by sort of carrying very complicated divisibility conditions through the induction, or by saying, I know that the answer is somehow related to the Alexander polynomial, and then use the fact that the Alexander polynomial is a polynomial. So I I'm not satisfied with it. But anyway, at the moment, that's not what I want to talk about. Okay, anyway, so this is the kind of new theorem. And the implementation is, we started talking about it last time, And basically, not last time, the time before last time, and basically nothing changes except the formulas are slightly different. Okay? So the same principles. So here is the value of a crossing. So since I don't want to have H's at all, the L part, I write log of T instead of H, but then the coefficients of the of that part end up being exponentiated, so the log disappears. And then here is the swap formula for F or E across an L, and it's just copied from over here, and here is the E across F swap formula. And again, I don't know if I should go through it. I think I more or less went through it two meetings ago or three meetings ago, and I have nothing really exciting to say about it. But anyway, you can then compute. So, okay, this is the trefoil, written as positive crossing where 4 goes over 1, and then positive crossing where 2 goes over 5, then positive crossing where 6 go over 3, and then I can compute its value, and this is before doing any stitchings, and then I progressively stitch things together, and the answer becomes more and more complicated until at the end I get, basically the Alexander polynomial here. Again, why is it the Alexander polynomial? Not now. Okay. Why am I telling you all of this? Because I wanted to make one further comment. Okay? So, the one further comment is that once you have a program written in this way, you no longer depend on all the very complicated rationale that led to these formulas. Okay, so the rationale was complicated. It was, you know, you have a Lie algebra G0. I didn't explain to you where it came from. Compute various complicated commutation relations. Some of them I do by using some three-dimensional representations. Some of them I need to use the heat equation in order to derive them. It's not too bad, but at the end it's very complicated. So, you know, if you have absolute trust in mathematics, then you've proven that this is an invariant. But I sort of I lose trust in proofs after a certain length because I tend to make mistakes. So it's nice to have verifications, and what I wanted to emphasize is that the moment you have a program which works for tangles, you can just you can verify that it's an invariant no matter where the formulas come from. And in a way, the moment I told you that everything depends on these four formulas, it doesn't matter what rationale got to these formulas. Somebody else might have different rationale that leads to these formulas. The formulas don't really say Lie algebras within them. So somebody else might have obtained these formulas without knowing anything about Lie algebras, but coming from a completely different philosophy. This is the invariant. This is an invariant. Anyway, once you have a program, you can prove it. So basically, what do you need to show? To show that it's an invariant. First of all, you need to show that the stitching procedure is well defined. This has nothing to do with Rademeister moves. This has nothing to do with Rademeister 1, 2, or 3. Right? You need to show that, right, if you have a complicated knot, then obtained by taking several crossings and stitching them, then it doesn't matter in which order you stitch. Once you know this, then somebody is calling me. Once you know this, Then you can, for example, if you want to prove Rademeister 3, you can declare that you will do the stitchings that do the Rademeister 3 before all other stitchings, and then you do them for the left-hand side, and then you do them for the right-hand side, and if you get the same answer, you have an invariant. Okay? So first of all, you need to know that that it doesn't matter in which order you do the stitchings. Well, that has two parts. One part is sort of a certain commutativity, which is basically if you have four pieces and you stitch here and then here, or you stitch here and then here, you get the same answer. You have to look at it to make sure that it's true, but it's easy. And then the other part is the meta-associativity. Namely, if you have three things, then stitching in this order, or first this and then that, gives the same answer. And that one is hard. It's not a priori obvious. Anyway, the moment you have a program, you can just verify it. So you let zeta be the most general thing you can write with four strands. Why four? Because I really want to do, I really need three strands that will play in the game, and then one extra strand that represents all others. So all coefficients that pertain to it are actually rows or columns of coefficients, but the formulas don't care. So you write the most general thing you can write with four strands. So omega is an arbitrary thing. The L part is an arbitrary linear combination with coefficients aij. The Q part is an arbitrary linear combination with coefficients bij, and where the aijs and the bijs are symbolic, so they could be anything. If you prove anything with symbolic variables, then you've proven it for all possible values. So this is zeta, and now you can start doing stitchings. So let's stitch 1 and 2 in zeta, and here is the ugly answer, okay? But it doesn't really matter what the ugly answer is. Here is an answer, okay? Now let's do stitch 1 and 2, and then 2 and 3, and then the resulting, which is 1, into 3. So this will be very, very awful. So I added the short around it. Actually, let's remove it. Short will, you know what? Just for the mathematical lesson, let's print it short. So short prints it shortened, and it came out too short. Actually, let me do short but 5 lines. Okay, so if you print, it's approximately 5 lines. The algorithm of shortening is not exact. So you find that you get a horrible formula with 224 terms not shown. Okay? Now, if I really wanted, I could remove the short and you will see the whole formula. But that doesn't really matter. What matters is if I do the stitchings 1, 2 into 1 and then 1, 3 into 1, or 2 and 3 and then 1 and 2, then I want to get the same answer. I can just tell the computer to evaluate, wait a few seconds, and get the answer true. Okay, so therefore, the stitching procedure is well defined. Once I know that it is well defined, I can check if Rademeister 3 is correct. And I need to check it only once, because, again, I can arrange that if I have a note with on which I want to do a Rademeister 3, I can arrange that the stitchings for Rademeister 3 will appear first. So here is the left-hand side. Okay, so, you know, on the screen there is the information in Rademeister 3, and then here is the left-hand side, and it's not too bad. What? It's too simple. What did I do wrong? That can't be true. What? Oops. What went wrong? Sorry, when I... Something is wrong here because it's too simple. I mean, there are actual computations to make. Oh, you know something? Maybe? Could it be that in this basis it actually is simple? I think it is. Sorry, once you've changed... Sorry. I remembered it complicated, but I remembered it complicated from before the change to the polished version. So it actually is right. And the point is that the left-hand side and the right-hand side are equal. Anyway, homework. Use the same methodology to verify the part that I skipped, and also to verify the Rider-Meister 2 moves, and to verify that Rider-Meister 1 doesn't cause any trouble. It actually doesn't hold, but it doesn't cause any problem. This is the usual thing about frame knots. Okay. Yeah, that's all I have to say about G0. No, I'm lying to you. I had more to say about G0, but it's in the it's already in the G1 chapter. Okay. So what I was meaning to do, and I started preparing it on Saturday, was to tell you. Okay, so G0 is a lovely Lie algebra. We need to look for other Lie algebras with which we can work. But, you know, why not start with SL2, sort of the Lie algebra that everybody loves the most, and show you that with SL2 you totally fail. Things simply don't work. Okay? So I started typing into Mathematica what you would need to do in order to commute things in SL2. And I was expecting to get horrible formulas that you simply can't work with. Okay? And then I was totally surprised to find that the formulas are... You can't work with them, but they're not horrible. So if you can extract something from them nevertheless. So I'm going to tell you about SL2 for a minute. Okay? So SL2, or in fact, sorry, I need SL2 together with an additional factor, that a billion factors that commutes with everything else. And that's just GL2. Basically, you add the identity matrix. You add multiples of the identity matrix. So really, I'm working with GL2. But still, I don't like to think of it as GL2, because if you were doing it for SLN, then the correct generalization would not be GLN. Possibly I'm not even telling you the truth. Anyway. Maybe I should have shown you what happens with SL2. So you know what? Let me show you what happens with SL2. Okay, so I'm going to type new stuff a little bit. So let me copy paste the title and make the header SL2. And then what's SL2? So SL2 is the Lie algebra with three generators. So H, which is 1 minus 1, and E, which is actually usually taken to have 1 at the top and 0 everywhere else, and F, which is opposite of what I said, which is usually taken to have 1 at the bottom, and that's all. So just 3 generators, so I can remove this one. And maybe I don't want name clashes, so with what will follow, so instead of calling it instead of calling this representation rho, I should call it something else. Do you have suggestions? R. Okay. So represented R, represented E, and represented F. Let's verify that this really is SL2. Okay. Let's remind ourselves what are the commutation relations of SL2. So first of all, the matrix bracket of X, which is a matrix, and Y, which is a matrix, is defined to be X times Y minus Y times X. And let's just verify, or let's even compute, what is the matrix bracket of RH with RE. Okay? So the result is, no, I don't want to execute everything. Okay. Oops, sorry, I should have executed this first. So what's the matrix bracket of RH with RE? Well, unfortunately, it's not written as a matrix, so let's rewrite it in matrix form. It appears to be twice times E. Okay? And likewise, let's compute the matrix bracket of H with F, and the result is -2F. And finally, let's compute the matrix bracket with of E and F, and the result is H. If you've seen SL2 before, have you, by the way? Then, okay, so at least math is consistent. You know, I could have shortened it by asking the computer to compute each of these. So E with F should be, yeah, you know what, maybe I shouldn't. It's enough that we know that this is true. Okay, now I want to understand reordering. And for this, I need to be able to write E to the alpha E times E to the beta H in some in the order where H will appear before E. Okay? This H, by the way, is not the same H of before. It doesn't commute with everything. Okay? However, this E and this H have roughly the same commutation relations as in G0. So here the commutation relation is, no, I think it's H with E, is 2E, and over there it was, what was it? E and L was, sorry, so H plays the role of L. So E and L was, I don't remember, plus or minus E. So up to some rescaling, the same formulas work. So there is really no issue, no problem, computing or swapping E or F across an H. The only issue would be swapping an E across an F. Or swapping, E to the E across an E to the F. Okay? But again, since I have a computer, I can just compute it. Okay? Or I can try to just do it. Okay? So let's do it. So let's do matrix exp of alpha row E, represented E, and okay, that's easy enough. Let's compute matrix exp of beta times represented F, and again, that's easy enough. Let's compute their product. So here is their product, and let's put it in matrix form, and again, that's, oops, sorry, I took the product of twice the same thing, beta F, and again, that's easy enough, okay? Now, my hope is to be able to write it in the opposite order, as a product of exponentials given in the opposite order. So, except, okay, so let's try that. So let's see if I can find some B or some A such that if I write it as, so I'm looking for A and B such that, sorry, matrix X, such that A times, so if I exponentiate A times F and then B times E, the result would be the same. Sorry, matrix form. So are there A and B such that these two matrices are equal? Obviously not, because A would have to be equal, alpha would have to be equal to B, A would have to be equal to beta, and then 1 plus A alpha beta is not equal to 1. Okay? So, on the other hand, it's not really what I was expecting. I mean, all I want is to be able to write it in as a product of exponentials in canonical order. And canonical order would be, let's declare that it is EFH. Oh, so I started with something which is already in canonical order. So let me write it in not canonical order. And now I want it to be in canonical order. So E, F, and then I can add matrix exp of C times H. Ah, and now it's conceivable that you can solve for A, B, and C that would satisfy this. So let's try, okay? So let's write the equation. I hope I'm not wasting your time. Left-hand side is equal to right-hand side. Well, actually, I wanted it to become a system of equations, right? Not one matrix is equal to another. So let me, or so you know what, let's call this equations, equation one, or equation, I don't know what. Well, okay, one. Equation one. No, let's make it two, because I think I've used one later. So this is equation two, but what I want to do I want to flatten both sides of equation 2. So now it's an equation, one vector is equal to another, and now I want to thread this. So thread the result. Now this is a system of equations. Now I want to solve it. So let's do solve. Oh, so this I should call equation 3. It's really equation. Well, it should be used plural. Equations 3. So now I want to solve equations 3 with respect to the variables. So the unknowns are A, B, and C. So with respect to A, B, and C, and here you go, the computer gives a solution. Okay? This ugly answer for C is the ugly way that the computer writes e to the 2 pi I n, where n is an unknown. So it's really, e to, if you look at it, it's 2 pi I C1, where C1 belongs to the integers. Okay? So, you know, and if you don't believe me, let's do solve e to the x, sorry, e to the power x is equal to 1 with, is equal to 1 with respect to the variable x, and that's the ugly way that the computer, that Mathematica writes solutions like this. So basically, or you know, if I want, I could, if I wanted to specialize, I could take this and apply the rule that C1 is 0. So just make the undetermined integer be 0, and this is completely reasonable. Okay? The only thing that is unreasonable with it is that I wouldn't know how to carry it through induction. So, if you... Okay, I wouldn't know how to do the heat equation trick with this. So, the formulas are not ugly, but I don't know how to do the rest of the process with them. And I don't expect the rest of the process to work, because we know for other reasons that the SL2 invariant is the Jones polynomial, and it should be exponential time to compute. So the rest of the process should not work. Okay, sorry, this is more disorganized than the usual. Anyway, what I really wanted to say is, well, I never told you how G0 and G1 and all the other Lie algebras arise. I will at some point, but let me tell you now that they arise by looking at certain limits of SL2. By modifying the commutation relations of SL2 in certain ways. And in fact, there is a family of Lie algebras, G epsilon, which, let me say differently. There is a family of commutation relations, G epsilon, which, for every constant epsilon, is isomorphic to GL2. For every epsilon other than 0, I should say, is isomorphic to SL2, to GL2, but the isomorphism is singular as epsilon goes to 0. However, the structure constants are not singular as epsilon goes to 0. So as epsilon goes to 0, you get G0 and G1. Okay? So, and in fact, here is that family. Namely, G epsilon is hereby declared to be the Lie algebra generated by H, E, L, and F as before, with the same commutation relations as before. H is still central, and the only modification is here in yellow. So instead of EF is equal to H, EF is H minus 2 epsilon L. Okay? And for epsilon not equal to zero, this is GL2, and the isomorphism is written right below. Namely, you can represent H as the identity matrix, a multiple of the identity matrix, E as all of this is showing that my conventions are not set up right. But E is epsilon times what used to be called F. L is this funny matrix which has a 1 over epsilon in it. And F is 0, 1, 0, 0. Now, the commutation relations of these matrices are exactly the commutation relations written above. Namely, let's verify it. If I set these matrices to be that and I verify the commutation relations, I get that they're all equal. Okay? What did I want to say? So again, for epsilon other than zero, this is GL2. But the commutation relations make sense even if epsilon is equal to zero. And when epsilon is equal to zero, you get our G0, right? If epsilon is equal to zero, this term drops out. So you get our G0. But that gives me an alternative strategy for proving the G0 lemmas. Namely, I prove the corresponding lemma for GL2. Well, I actually already told you how to do it. And then, if the lemmas have a limit as epsilon goes to zero, I get my lemmas for G0. So let's check that. So here are two of the G epsilon lemmas. So they are in fact identical to the G0 lemmas because the change we made doesn't touch L and E. It only touches the commutator of E and F. So it doesn't touch these two things. But now I have a new proof, right? The proof I used to have involved multiplying 3x3 matrices. Now all I have to do is to multiply 2x2 matrices. Namely, I can use the representation above. So here is the proof of the first identity. Here is the proof of the second identity. In both cases, you get that this is equal to that. This is true for every epsilon. Therefore, it's also true for epsilon equals to zero. Okay? Now, I want to derive lemma 3 at delta equals to zero. Okay? So the exponential form of lemma 3. Before the heat equation nonsense. Okay? So I do exactly what I did before. So I multiply alpha times F and beta times E and see what comes out, and it's not too bad because after all it's just GLN with some change of basis. Then I write the same equation as I wrote before, and I find its solution. It will have only one solution, but Mathematica nevertheless gives a list of solutions, of a list of length 1. So I take the first element of that list, and here it is. And again, I kill C1, and here is the solution, and it's not too bad. And so we find that in G epsilon, we have the following reordering rule. So if you want to reorder alpha F plus beta E from the order FE to the order ELF, the result is CH plus AE minus 2 epsilon CL plus BF, where A, B, and C are written here. And I've copy-pasted them from here. Okay? Now, at epsilon equals to 0, so this is true for any epsilon. So at epsilon goes to 0, I just have to take the limit of A, B, and C after I replace them by the values given by the solution, and I have to take the limit as epsilon goes to 0. So here is what I get. And this is, and that's exactly what I got before. So basically, if you look at this, at with A, B, and C equals to the numbers written here, you find and at epsilon equals to 0, so this term drops, and you get, well, whatever you have left is exactly what we had before. So here is so I just found a 2x2 derivation of what was before 3x3. Okay, but now the...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a silly question?
Yeah.
So I don't know anything about quantum groups, but there's this parameter they have, and sometimes it goes to 0 when you read like the first paragraph.
I think it's not the same. It's not the same.
It's nothing to do with...
I don't want to say it's nothing to do, okay. But it's not the same parameter.
Okay. It's not a direct... Okay.
No. And I don't exactly understand the relationship. So, I don't exactly understand the relationship with SL2, but... So, okay. With quantum groups, but that's besides the point. So, here... For quantum groups, the limiting value of the parameter is the group you started from. And here, the limiting value of the parameter, when you send epsilon to 0, you don't get SL2, you get G0. Okay? Okay, so now I can tell you what G1 is. I never told you what G1 is. So G1 is, by the way, if you notice, I called this family of Lie algebras G up epsilon. So G sub 0 is G up epsilon at epsilon equals to 0. G sub 1 is G up epsilon at epsilon squared is equal to 0. So, in other words, G up 1, you know, maybe I'll take a picture and sort of start a fresh page with G1.
Sorry, G up 1 is when...
Sorry, G sub 1 is... I guess the only title I can give this picture is random. Okay, so maybe I'll just write it. So G up epsilon is the Lie algebra generated by Helf subject to so E with L. Does anybody
read? Minus E.
Is minus E? Is this what we have? Yes. F with L is F. E with F is H minus 2 epsilon L. And H is central. Okay? And then, G0 is defined to be G epsilon modulo the relation epsilon is equal to 0. And then it's the one that we've studied for a long time, and the only thing that happens is that this drops. Okay? And then G1 is G, so G1 is a bit hard to say. So it's G epsilon, but regarded over the ring. So instead of thinking of it as a Lie algebra over Q, you regard it as a Lie algebra over the ring Q adjoint epsilon with epsilon squared is equal to zero. So as a Lie algebra over Q, so it's eight dimensional because it is generated by H E L F epsilon H epsilon E epsilon E epsilon L and epsilon F. So if you want to think of it as a Lie algebra over Q, it's an eight dimensional Lie algebra. But then writing the relations is a bit boring. It's just these relations with epsilon squared equals set to zero. Okay? So, right. So, you know, so, okay, so maybe before, maybe we should take a short break. But before the break, I want to tell you my goal. So my goal is to fully understand reorderings for G1. Okay? And up until now, it was hard because I didn't have this, because I, in fact, did not have any matrix representation for it. And now I found, and over the weekend, I found that I have a 2x2 matrix representation. So it's actually very easy. Okay, so let's take a break and continue at 2:12, let's say.